We're discussing future treatments for Lyme disease here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the CDC, about 476,000 people in the U.S. are diagnosed and treated for Lyme disease each year. But that's really ballpark. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say there's really no way of knowing. People and animals can be infected by the bacteria transmitted through the bite of an infected deer tick. An antibiotic treatment is effective for most treatments, but not all. Some people suffer from symptoms like fatigue, muscle pain, and cognitive impairment. Did you recover from Lyme disease or have lingering symptoms? It's 800-642-1234 to share your story. Kim Lewis is a distinguished professor of biology at Northeastern University, where he directs the Antimicrobial Discovery Center. And he co-authored a study this month in the journal Cell. It's called A Selective Antibiotic for Lyme Disease. Kim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here, especially since I was a postdoc in the University of Madison.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
So people treated with oral antibiotics in the early stages of Lyme disease, the CDC says they usually recover rapidly and completely. Case closed. What if the round of antibiotics doesn't work and symptoms persist? Then what happens?
What happens is what is known as either chronic Lyme or post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. We do not understand the nature of that disease. We just know the symptomology, muscle ache and pain, foggy mind, and fatigue. And currently there is no treatment against this really devastating condition.
Yeah, and the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has found in its studies that long-term outcomes are no better for patients who received additional prolonged antibiotic treatment. And in fact, serious complications could occur. Is there disagreement in the medical community over how to treat Lyme?
Yes, this is a controversial subject. Some doctors think that patients do not actually have post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, but this problem has been illuminated by the COVID pandemic, because now there's no question that a number of patients suffer from long COVID. Symptoms of long COVID are very similar to symptoms of chronic Lyme disease. It appears that a number of infectious diseases apparently wrecks the immune system, and then patients end up with this with these chronic symptoms.
Well, let's go into your lab, and you say Lyme disease is in a good position to be eradicated. What are you proposing?
We reasoned that it is not a good idea to treat the Lyme disease with broad spectrum antibiotics because they can wreck your gut microbiome, the collection of symbiotic bacteria that are so important for many aspects of health and have been linked causally to a number of autoimmune diseases. So we think that treatment with broad spectrum antibiotics, which is of course unavoidable at the moment for acute Lyme disease, may be contributing to the development of the chronic phase of the disease. So we set out to find a compound that is going to selectively kill the Lyme disease spirochete, Borrelia burgdorferi, and nothing else, not harm your microbiome, and perhaps diminish the probability of development of the chronic disease. And then in patients with chronic disease, if there is a lingering infection in some of them, then again, you would want to treat it with an antibiotic that is not broad spectrum, but selective. And maybe that will make a difference. So that's on the therapeutic side. But then on the side of eradication, I think that a Lyme disease is well poised to be eradicated, just as smallpox has been eradicated, or malaria in the U.S. and other developed countries. We have put the compound that we found, hygromycin A, which is highly selective against the spirochete, we put it in a bait, I fed it to mice, and that cleared the disease in mice very well. They were cleared of the spirochete infection. So now we're gearing up to do a field experiment, which will start next year, the support from NIH to put these baits into the wild and see if it clears the infection from mice, which are the primary carriers. I mean, it's called a deer tick, but it is the mice that we need to worry about most of all. If we can clear the infection from mice in the wild, then this will break the chain of transmission, and there is a potential to eradicate the disease from the environment.
We're talking with Kim Lewis, a biology professor at Northeastern University. We're discussing what could bring Lyme disease in check, under control. Are you worried about getting Lyme disease? Do you have the disease? Does someone you know have it? How do you manage symptoms? What do you want to know about the effects of Lyme disease? Join in at 800-642-1234. So when you looked at this compound, hygromycin A, the primary component of your treatment to fight Lyme disease, where did you find the compound?
Well, so we actually placed a bet that nature would bother to evolve a compound that acts selectively against spirochetes. Bacteria fight each other with antibiotics, soil bacteria, and then we borrow those antibiotics and develop them into drugs. So they're soil spirochetes that are competitors of many soil bacteria. And so we started testing soil bacteria for ability to produce something that will kill a spirochete, but not other conventional bacteria like, I don't know, Staph or E. coli. And so we hit upon a compound that was highly selective against all spirochetes we tested, including Borrelia burgdorferi. And I was convinced that this is a novel compound. That's what I told my guys from the lab, because it wasn't known that there's a natural antibiotic that is selective against spirochetes. Well, to our surprise, once we determined its structure, it turned out to be an old abandoned antibiotic, hygromycin A. Just nobody tested it against spirochetes. And it's a lousy antibiotic against other pathogens. So that's why it was never developed.
Oh, because it only really does one thing. It's very specialized.
It's pretty special. It evolved to kill spirochetes. That's what it does.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when you look at the side effects of treating with broad spectrum antibiotics, and we know these names from other infections, doxycycline, amoxicillin. Can you explain why the broad spectrum antibiotic approach isn't a good fit for Lyme disease?
Yeah, well, the primary reason for the poor fit is that these antibiotics, as was known and as we confirm in this study that you cited, they're really bad for your microbiome. I mean, they will kill indiscriminately symbionts that live in our guts and help us, among other things, to keep a healthy immune system. So now you wreck the microbiome with the broad spectrum antibiotic, and on top of the infection, which also affects the immune system. I think that the combination of these two factors is what probably brings on post-treatment Lyme syndrome. So we have a hope that this compound that's wrecking your microbiome and causing that, as you say, side effect, that will diminish the probability of developing a chronic disease.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing the possibility of scientists discovering a targeted treatment for acute Lyme disease with Northeastern University biology professor Kim Lewis here. Have you had debilitating effects from Lyme? What are your symptoms? What has your doctor tried? Have you had Lyme disease multiple times? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kim Lewis here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how to treat Lyme disease, the tick-borne illness with cases on the rise, according to the CDC. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So a group of researchers writing this month in the journal Cell have described a new antibiotic that appears to have the potential to cure Lyme disease. Have you been diagnosed with Lyme? Did a general antibiotic treatment work for you? If a vaccine for Lyme disease came to market, would you take it? Join in 800-642-1234. Kim Lewis is a biology professor at Northeastern in Boston, heads the Antimicrobial Discovery Center there. Let's go to John now in Jackson. Hi, John.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Kim. So I was about 30 years old. I like to spend a lot of time in the Kettle Moraine Forest, and I never realized how seriously bad the Lyme could get. So I picked it up a couple years ago. I don't have any of the long-term effects, but I started running out of energy at work. I had a couple days where my neck was having a hard time turning, and I started getting really tired all the time. So I went into the emergency room because I thought I might be having, there's obviously something very wrong. I couldn't even barely walk across the room without wanting to fall over. And they basically told me to tough it out. It probably wasn't anything serious. And the next day I ended up collapsing and almost having a heart attack. My heart really stopped beating. So if you think you have it, you got to make 100% sure that you get diagnosed properly, because I almost ended up losing my life over that scenario.
John, thank you for sharing your story. Kim Lewis, this can be extremely dangerous.
Yes. I am happy that you recovered. You recovered properly. What you probably had was Lyme carditis. The spirochete, it has a shape of a spiral. That's what it's caused, and it bores into organs and tissues. So it's a nasty pathogen. It can really mess up your life.
Let's go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi. What is your question about Lyme?
Morning. Thank you. I assume that patients that have that are dealing with post-treatment Lyme are not eligible or able to get the hygromycin treatment. So what would the researcher suggest for those who are dealing with long-term effects of Lyme? Thank you.
Jim, thank you. What would you suggest if you're dealing with these long-term symptoms?
Jim, that is a tough question. I can say that I'm not a physician, but my colleagues and friends who are physicians, they have a very tough time treating patients who have post-treatment Lyme, because we do not have at the moment an approved treatment for post-treatment Lyme disease.
Go ahead.
That's, of course, one of the motivations for us to develop this therapeutic that we're discussing.
Yeah. Well, let's take Gene and Almond. Gene, hi. What is your question about the vaccine?
Well, I got my a vaccine for it about 25 years ago. It was a series of three shots. And then they stopped making it. And I'm curious about why they stopped making it.
Yeah, that's a great question, Gene. Kim, go ahead.
Yeah, there are two reasons for stopping to make the vaccine. One, there was a controversy about that vaccine possibly causing an autoimmune effect in some people. That was never proven. Probably that wasn't real. But perhaps the more serious reason was that the market wasn't there. With three shots and this disease not being, life-threatening for most people, it's just that people didn't have much of a motivation or enthusiasm to get vaccinated. And this question is, brought into perspective by our current COVID pandemic, where you will die from COVID with a distinct possibility. So this is a life and death question, whether you take the vaccine or not. And yet, 20 to 30% of people are not interested in being vaccinated. That doesn't bode very well for, the prospect of having the population being vaccinated against Lyme disease.
Hmm. We only have a minute left. I'm wondering, what is the future of your research? Where does it go next?
We are developing hygromycin A into a drug, doing additional animal safety and toxicity testing. The compound seems to be very safe. We don't see any side effects or any toxicity. And I hope that it will move into clinical trials and become a drug.
And clinical trials, that phase would be on animals or humans? How would that work?
So clinical trials is always on humans. You start with healthy volunteers to the safety, and then you treat patients with Lyme disease to see if it properly clears the disease. And apart from that, we will, of course, be curious to see if the antibiotic we're developing diminishes the probability for the emergence of a chronic phase of the disease.
Kim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. My pleasure.
Kim Lewis, professor of biology at Northeastern University. We have a link to the paper titled A Selective Antibiotic for Lyme Disease, published in the journal Cell. This is The Morning Show. And now, Wisconsin law enforcement agencies have had difficulty recruiting and keeping officers for years. The national reckoning last year over racial justice and calls for police reform only added to agency struggles. As Danielle Kading reports, the pandemic, rising violence, and intense scrutiny of police have made it more challenging to attract and keep officers.
Lauren Phillips remembers watching with her police academy classmates in Eau Claire this past spring as they waited for a verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. She says what Chauvin did was wrong, and they wanted justice to be served.
Everyone was anxious. Everyone was hoping that the right thing would come about. But at the same time, we're all sitting there like, what happens if this goes south? We were still recruits in the academy, but we still wore shirts that said, like, CVTC law enforcement.
Phillips and fellow students would change their shirts or grab a jacket before going out in public. Officers have faced intense outrage and criticism since Chauvin murdered George Floyd last May, igniting worldwide protests calling for police accountability. The negative attitudes toward police didn't sway Phillips. Now on patrol for Superior Police, she wants to bring more respect to law enforcement.
And they will remember you, and they will remember the things that you do. So it's one of those things to take into...
71.
It's just one of those things to be cognizant of when you are out in the community.
But it's getting harder to attract people like Phillips. A national survey of nearly 200 police departments found hiring dropped, while retirements rose 45% and resignations climbed by 18% from April of last year to this spring. Executive Director Jim Palmer with the Wisconsin Professional Police Association says the pandemic and intense scrutiny have made it more challenging to draw and keep officers.
There are more options for younger people today that pay better and don't require them to put their lives and their personal safety at risk, and that don't carry the significant enhanced scrutiny.
Massive protests unfolded in Milwaukee and Madison last year with calls to defund police. In Milwaukee, retirements among Milwaukee police spiked nearly 40% last year, with 131 officers calling it a career. In the last 5 years, more than 500 Milwaukee cops have retired. In an interview with the city's Fire and Police Commission, acting Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman says the loss of officers is a challenge.
And so we need to have, again, something that we have not had in a long time. A consistency of a transition of when those particular type of individuals move on, are we able to continue to lift without having a blip on the radar?
Under the next budget, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is proposing to use COVID-19 stimulus funds to train 195 new officers next year.
Overall, the total strength of the department will be on average 1,657, not quite keeping pace with retirements.
In Madison, the number of applicants for this year's recruit class dropped by nearly 44%. The Police Association's Palmer thinks investment in community policing is crucial to building trust between officers and communities they serve. Megan Stroshein is an associate professor of criminology and law studies at Marquette University. She says more community policing would be a step in the right direction.
If we can improve the relationship between the police and the public, policing will become a more attractive position.
But Marquesa Tucker-Harris with the African American Roundtable says Milwaukee police have been talking about community policing for a long time, and she doesn't see it making a difference. She's been pushing for cuts to police budgets. She says taxpayer money should be shifted away from law enforcement to support housing assistance and other programs to address the root causes of poverty and violence.
What we do know
is what we've been doing isn't working. And we can't continue to waste money. We can't continue to allow lives to continue to be destroyed and lost.
The number of homicides had been falling in recent years across Milwaukee, but killing spiked during the pandemic last year with a record 190 homicides. The city is on track to break that record this year as police staffing in Milwaukee hits a record 20-year low. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And coming up, you have a line to Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on redistricting, his election review probe, and agenda for Wisconsin. What do you want to ask the highest-ranking Republican in the State Assembly? Join in, 800-642-1234. News update is next here in the Ideas Network. You have a line to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Voss, a Republican, has been Speaker longer than anyone in state history, representing a district that stretches from his hometown of Burlington to the western edge of Racine. Here's some roadmap for our discussion. It'll be helpful. We'll look at redistricting, what happens to the maps drawn by Republicans a decade ago, his election review helmed by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman, and we begin with Voss's stature in state politics. What do you want to ask the Speaker of the State Assembly? 800-642-1234. Speaker Voss, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. So that recent profile of you in Politico magazine labeled you as the shadow governor of Wisconsin. What did you make of that characterization?
Well, obviously, it's something that a guy from Washington put in the article. I certainly believe in our constitutional system where you have equal branches of government. Unfortunately, it appears in other states, perhaps legislative leaders have ceded an awful lot of authority to their governor. But in our state, and hopefully in everyone around the country, the legislature and the leaders in it should be the equals of the governor as they fight for public policy. And I think that's where we are in Wisconsin.
Do you feel like you use your power as the assembly's highest ranking Republican to stifle policy goals of the governor?
Not necessarily. I mean, the things we can find common ground, that's really important. That's the way that the founders of our nation and our state really intended it, was for people of goodwill to sit down, find common ground, but of course, on areas of disagreement, fight for their principles and perhaps not find agreement, in this legislative session. But as elections happen and we have a chance to make our case to the public, sometimes one side or the other is swayed. That's the way I think we did with Governor Evers, because remember, he introduced a budget that had massive tax increases, a 10% increase in spending, and he totally backed down after the legislature passed the budget, which actually had a very substantial tax decrease and one of the lowest spending increases in the past couple decades. So obviously the public has an influence, and Governor Evers backed down the legislature because we had better public policy.
So where else have you found common ground with Evers?
It's a difficult challenge. I look and see where we actually were able to pass some police reforms. Those were headed up by our Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparities, headed by Jim Steinecke. I think that was a good example where we came up with positive ideas in a bipartisan way, sent those to Governor Evers for his signature in their law today.
You met on November 20th of last year with Governor Evers about slowing the spread and pandemic relief. Have there been any productive meetings since then with the governor?
No, the governor doesn't really want to meet with us. If you listen to the news reports, he said he didn't think it'd be a productive use of his time. We have sent letters. We have asked for meetings. But unfortunately, Governor Evers' style is kind of go it alone. And, as a constitutional officer, he has the right to do that. So the legislature is proceeding to pass good public policy and trying to influence the debate as best we can and sending things to Governor Evers for his final signature. It's just different. And that's why if you look at what that article pointed out, in most places around the country, even people who are in different political parties meet, they talk, they try to find common ground. Governor Evers has just decided that's not his style, so we don't do that.
So when you have asked to meet with the governor, what do you want to meet on? What is your agenda?
Well, there's an awful lot of things. I mean, one of the things the legislature is going to pass during the course of the next few weeks is dealing with the workforce housing problem. You know, we have a couple demographic challenges that really structured the way that we look at this topic and how we're going to deal with it in the future. We have a graying population. Older folks stay in Wisconsin because they're a great place to live. If you remember, Governor Walker put in a very aggressive talent attraction campaign to try to draw young people and those who would, you know, kind of keep our state reinvigorated as we create more and more jobs. One of the first things Governor Evers did was to eliminate that talent attraction. So I think that was a mistake. We need to do a better job of bringing people, you know, of every income bracket, those who are college graduates, but people who might want to become a plumber or work in a factory. We need more people to come to Wisconsin. And part of the challenge that we have is housing is really expensive in an awful lot of the state. I was just at a meeting yesterday where they talked about the cost of building a new home is substantial and in many ways out of reach for an average two-earning couple. So we have to figure a way to reduce those costs. Part of it's regulation, part of it's making sure that every community has access to all kinds of housing, not just high-end. So I think those are things that we should be able to find common ground on. But again, you know, it takes two to tango.
Well, let's take a call now. Louis is joining us from Oconto. Hi, Louis. What would you like to ask Speaker Voss?
Yes, I'd like to ask the Speaker. It seems like Kate was talking about this, how there's just infighting. I don't know how the Packers would ever win if the defense always fought the offense. But I'd like to ask two questions. One is, can they point to something that they've done in the last 10 months on the Republican side to help the average middle-class family here in Wisconsin? Is there a positive other than saying we cut taxes? And also, is there a fair way of doing this redistricting that it's going to be fair for both parties to slug it out?
And we're going to get to redistricting here in just a moment. But taking Louis' first question, tax cuts aside, what would you say there, Speaker Voss?
Sure. Well, thanks for the question, Louis. One of the things that I am most proud of is over the course of the past two budgets, not just the last one, but the one before, we have made substantial investments in our healthcare system. So, of course, people know you get healthcare through three means, Medicare if you're over 65, Medicaid if you're in poverty, and then traditional insurance that we have either through the Obamacare exchange or through your employer. So we were able to put substantial dollars into each one of those that the state controls. So we increased funding for Medicaid dental, which means dental services for the poor, by the largest in almost 20 years. We were able to put more money into the Obamacare exchanges to draw down those premiums so people who are of modest means buying insurance on that private marketplace don't have to pay the super high costs being imposed kind of by the marketplace because of all the mandates coming from Washington, D.C. So those are certainly not aimed at wealthy people. They are aimed at middle class, average Americans who want to have access to good health insurance. There are some things that we'd like to work on. I certainly think that if you're able to access those benefits, we should have some kind of a requirement that you actively look for a job. We don't want people to be trapped in a life of poverty by saying that that's the only way they can get their health insurance, which is why even though, you know, I didn't agree with the initial funding and formation of Obamacare, and I still think it perverts the private sector marketplace, it's the law.
So why do Republicans quickly kill Medicaid expansion when it comes up, when there's overwhelming support from residents?
Well, Medicaid expansion is actually kind of a misnomer because what that would do is it would actually take the people who are on Obamacare already, getting private sector health insurance, paying private sector rates, and put them into a system called Medicaid where they are trapped in it. They don't have the ability to transport that when they move jobs, unlike Obamacare. They don't have the ability to actually pay a hospital or a doctor or a dentist the rates that are negotiated, which can keep them viable. So every single person on Medicaid has to be subsidized by those of us who have private sector health insurance or are on the exchange. So the more people we put into Medicaid, the higher the prices are for everybody else. I don't want anybody to pay more for private sector health insurance. And I think that's the challenge that a lot of Democrats and liberals want to push us toward a Canada-style, United Kingdom-style, one-size-fits-all, single-payer system by making it unaffordable for those of us in the private sector. We're not going to let that happen.
We're talking with Representative Robin Voss, Speaker of the State Assembly. He represents a district stretching from Burlington to Racine. Fielding your questions, 800-642-1234. Turning to your investigation of the 2020 presidential election, as you appointed former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman to head it, do you have reason to believe that the election was tainted?
I do. I mean, and I would say this. Do I believe in the end that Joe Biden won the election? Yeah, I think he did. There's no doubt he's the president. That's where we are. But we have got to look forward and figure out ways to guarantee that for the half of the state or more who believe that there were serious problems with the way the election was conducted, that we fix it going forward so everybody knows whoever wins the election, it was done fair and square and not through some kind of manipulation of the system. You look at what happened with this out-of-state money coming from the owners of Facebook, where they gave over $6 million to select cities to increase turnout of a certain demographic. Well, that is clearly, you know, a situation where imagine it happened in reverse, where the Koch brothers gave millions of dollars to only turn out people of white background in the suburbs. People would say that is crazy. Well, that's exactly what happened with the money from Zuckerberg in reverse, where they focused only on turning out minorities in large cities. They didn't use it to say, let's focus on turning out all voters. They actually communicated who voted directly with the Democratic Party to increase the number of Democrats turning out by using taxpayer resources to do so.
Well,
so
I think
there are a lot of questions about how it happened, and it was clearly
considering
wrong.
Taxpayer resources. Is your investigation on budget, or will you need more than $680,000?
Well, it really depends on how we keep going forward. I mean, we are discovering more and more on a regular basis about things that happened during the election.
Like what?
Eventually, when the reports come out, we're going to make those public. But we want to make sure we're putting it into a document that people can read and understand. But we clearly know that the clerks broke the law, which is why the Supreme Court said you can't do that. You can't let people say they're indefinitely confined when they're not. You can't let people cure a ballot, especially being done by a nonprofit group that basically took over the elections in certain parts of the state. You go back and you read the reports of the clerk at the time who raised red flags saying, why is somebody from New York City coming here and telling me how to run elections in Green Bay? And they basically said, sit down and shut up.
So
that's not the way the election should be happening.
Will election officials from the five cities sit before Gableman in closed-door interviews Friday per the subpoenas?
Well, I certainly hope they will cooperate. The goal of trying to have this investigation is to shine a light on all of the problems that occurred in 2020 so we don't see them happening again in 2022 and going forward. I think that's the thing that most shocks me. If there's nothing to hide, why are all these Democrats literally now working with liberal lawyers to try to ensure that nothing becomes public and that nothing sees the light of day?
But if there's nothing to hide, why have you failed to release documents related to your investigation that were submitted in an open records request?
Well, I mean, if you think about just the basic way an investigation is conducted, if the district attorney decides they're going to try to find out who killed somebody on the street corner, they do not put out for public display for everybody to read who they're talking to and who they're investigating, giving an advantage to the people who actually committed the crime to avoid prosecution. That's exactly what would happen if we decided to put all the documents out. And that's why liberals are asking for them. They want to try to torpedo our investigation. They don't want to get at the truth because they believe they've created a system which benefits liberals getting elected to state White office. We want a system that's fair for everybody. I don't want to benefit either side. And that's why I think when we look at the entire process, having a top-down investigation with an ultimate report that will be totally public, in addition to the one the legislature...
When will this report come out?
We're hoping it'll come out sometime in line with the legislature's forensic audit that's being done by the Audit Bureau. They said sometime in fall, and I would anticipate before the end of the year, we will also have documents to be able to share with the public.
We're in conversation with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. What do you think of how the Republican legislative majority has worked with Democratic Governor Evers? Still time to talk. Back in a minute with Speaker Voss here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're in conversation with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the highest-ranking Republican in the State Assembly. We're going to move on to redistricting, and Speaker Voss is with us for about 9 more minutes. Wesley in Fall Creek is going to lead us off on redistricting. Wesley, what is your question?
Yeah, Speaker Voss, you just said a few minutes ago that you want the election system to be completely fair, and you don't want anybody gaming the system. Well, I completely agree with you. There is a way to solve that problem completely with computer algorithms. Brown University and several others have released free and open source computer algorithms that can completely slice districts in an automatic way based on population density. Since you want free and completely fair election systems, will you commit to looking into that?
Go ahead, Speaker Voss.
Yeah, thank you for your question. Well, we actually already are doing that partially. If you look at how the process works, communities of interest is one of the things that it's very difficult for a computer algorithm to just say, you know, what communities are part of the same geographic region on more than paper. So I think that's one of the factors that we really put in there. It's one of the constitutional challenges to make sure communities of interest are able to be grouped together. So I think we have a good process in Wisconsin. I mean, if you look at what's happened, you know, there are places that have gone with a quote unquote independent redistricting commission. I think Milwaukee County or the city of Milwaukee is using it. When I listened to the news yesterday, they're on their third map because the elected officials, almost all Democrats, if not entirely Democrats, are rejecting the maps drawn by this independent commission. So it's a human process. It's a process where you try to do your very best to keep communities of interest together, to have one person, one vote. We saw what happened when they tried to use a computer algorithm with the People's Maps Commission from the governor, where they literally broke the Federal Voting Rights Act and disenfranchised minorities. So it's not as simple as just plugging it into a computer program. But I think the process we have in Wisconsin, where we're taking public input, we're pushing the ideas that people are giving us, hopefully into the final map, I think that's a good process. And it's one that ultimately has been used for a couple hundred years. And it's worked pretty well for our country.
In this human process, will Republicans need to sign non-disclosure agreements this time when they get to look at your maps?
No, that's actually just still a Democratic talking point you had from a decade ago. We have not used that process. We've been totally open. That was under a different speaker, a different time. So certainly not. We're actually in a transparent way allowing people to submit their own maps through our online portal. So I know for an awful lot of your listeners who lean liberal, they are looking for every possible way to criticize the process we're going through. But the reality is it's been found constitutional. It's working well in most other states around the country. And ultimately, I think we'll end up with good maps for Wisconsin that will guarantee we have those free and fair elections we've had for, you know, literally our state's history.
So if you're collecting people's maps and the way they draw the boundaries, what do you make of the Governor's People's Maps Commission and what they have released? Aren't those people's maps?
Well, not necessarily, because remember, they hired an expert out of state in secret to draw the maps. So it's kind of ironic that you just brought that up about secrecy agreements. While they didn't have an agreement, their expert doesn't even live in Wisconsin. So they brought the three draft maps out based on input, but they were, just like we're doing, being able to be drawn and then presented to the public. But I think the most important thing is making sure that we follow all of the constitutional guidelines, one person, one vote, protecting communities of color, ensuring that we have the ability for communities of interest to stay together. And in the end, I am very confident that the map we produce will meet all of those constitutional challenges.
All right. So the timeline here, when might the assembly unveil its map proposal and when is a vote expected?
So our goal is to have a map on the floor enacted before we adjourn our fall session, which ends, I believe, it's November 14th. So our goal is to have maps produced in the very near future with the ability to have the public comment on those. We'll have public hearings and then ultimately a vote before we leave in November.
Let's go to Jeff in Grand Marsh on redistricting. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm just curious, two questions. Why do we not have just square districts? And, well, they would naturally ebb and flow. More Democrats move out this cycle, next cycle, more Democrats move in, or Republicans. Choose your poison pill, but the district stays the same. Let the population determine which way it's going. Why is it we cannot do that?
Jeff, thank you. Voss, could you hear that?
Yes, I could. That's actually exactly how the system works right now. The only changes that we hope to make are for population. So, you know, a township decides to put in 10 new subdivisions and 1,000 new people move to town. Well, that has an impact if the place next door had no growth. So you have to try to balance the two out. So that's exactly why we do the redistricting every 10 years. It's mostly based on just changes in population. So our goal is to try to keep the districts in a similar place to where they are so people know who their state legislator is. But obviously, if you have that population growth, you have to move it.
Talking with Republican Robin Voss, Speaker of the State Assembly since 2013, Ethan is joining us from Janesville with a question regarding marijuana legalization. Ethan, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. You mentioned with the election that roughly half of the people in the state might want the election looked at, but we're ignoring the fact that 65-70% of the people on referendum support legal marijuana, and that's just a good business move. It sees a lot of dollars move into the state. And I want to know why we can't move past that without straw men.
Well, I'm sure most people who listen to the show know that I have been one of the earliest supporters of medical marijuana. I think that would be a very reasonable position for us to take. Somebody who's suffering with a chronic medical condition, if the best possible treatment for them is to be able to use cannabis, I certainly support that idea. I think that would be, if you look at the rest of the country, in almost every place, that is the natural thing that occurs first. I do not support the legalization of marijuana for recreational use at this time. I certainly believe that the first thing we should do is to help those folks who are in chronic pain. I think that's something we could accomplish.
Why don't you support full legalization?
Because I do not believe that the problem in our society is that we need to have more drugs. I think part of the problem is, and we look at where we are across the state, we see increasing use of all kinds of different recreational drugs. It doesn't make people more productive. It certainly doesn't help them to hold a job or pay for their families or not depend on government benefits. So for me, I think the reasonable place is to focus on helping people who have medical conditions deal with that. Let's see how it happens. And I think the experiment across the country is still very wide open, where it has not increased the number of people who are finding jobs. It has not increased the number of people who are supporting their families. And frankly, I think it's gone in the opposite direction. And that's the last thing our country needs, is more people on public benefits with those of us who are working paying for them.
I want to get your thoughts on Foxconn and the deal that Governor Walker signed. Governor Evers renegotiated. Are you happy with the progress that Foxconn has made?
Well, it's obviously slower than we would have hoped. If you would have come and said there's going to be almost 1,000 people working in Racine County, I think most of us would have said that's a fantastic thing, which is what's occurring right now. Is it the 13,000 that were originally promised? No. But the lucky thing is, about the original deal we cut, not a dollar of taxpayer money has gone to Foxconn, because it didn't meet the requirements of hiring the number of people at the wages that were specified. So the deal worked exactly as we cut it. It might not have been as optimistic as we had hoped with the 13,000 jobs, but if you're down there now, it is a fantastic facility with people from all across the country looking to expand there, because it is the most job-ready, shovel-ready, infrastructure-ready site in the entire country.
But what would you
eventually, we're going to have growth.
Yeah, what would you say to the Village of Mount Pleasant that has spent, you know, over $300 million on infrastructure, on roads, on, you know, all of these different things in order to get ready for this huge investment, and it doesn't come?
Well, and the nice thing is that they're not paying for it. It's actually being paid for by a special assessment that Foxconn is paying directly. So that's really the good news. If you look at the property taxes in Mount Pleasant, they're actually holding steady or going down, with the exception of the unified referendum for our school district. So that's the good thing, again, about the deal that we negotiated, is the downside for the taxpayer has been very minimalized, with the upside potential that all of these new facilities are going to be ready to be built in Racine County, perhaps not Foxconn, but other ones that will come there that are going to make us all proud.
I want to land here on President Trump and his values, his goals. What impact has he had on the Republican Party and on you and your leadership in Wisconsin?
So I've been in office longer than Donald Trump's been a candidate. I think that he brings energy, enthusiasm, and the ability to stand up for what Republicans really believe, which is a stronger individual, less reliance on the government, less ability to say that we're going to trust somebody else to make the decisions that really should be made by our family. I think that's why a lot of Republicans look at him and say he's a role model for the way that people want to see a fighter in office. I think we see what Democrats are doing, where they are constantly on the march, trying to advance the welfare state, trying to put more people into public benefits and less people on the work rolls. Those are things that frustrate an awful lot of us. And I think that's why people are desperate for somebody who actually is a leader. We saw with President Biden, many of the decisions that he's making, of course, he didn't talk about on the campaign trail. And certainly now he is advocating for a massive increase in welfare and spending that our kids are going to pay for.
Speaker Voss, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Robin Voss of Burlington. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.